Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the US Senate, where the Democrats increased their majority, and Majority Leader Harry Reid pledged today that he will change the Senate rules, which he said have been abused. A longtime senior Senate staffer, Ira Shapiro, joins us. He is the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, and we'll examine how the filibuster can be reformed and how the newly re-elected president can fast-track the huge backlog of judicial appointments that have been blocked by the Republican minority. Then we'll look at the House that remains in Republican hands, although some of the more incendiary Tea Party firebrands have lost their seats. Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years as a senior Republican staffer, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committee, joins us. The author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, we will discuss the coming showdown over the so-called fiscal cliff and next February's raising of the debt ceiling. Then finally, with the election of a lesbian to the United States Senate, gay marriage passing in Maine and Maryland, and marijuana legalized in Colorado and Washington State, the country apparently did not heed Paul Ryan's warning that Obama was putting America on a dangerous path that compromises Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. The author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God, Tanya Lerman, joins us. She is both a psychologist and an anthropologist, and we will discuss how much yesterday's election was a watershed with the apparent waning of the religious right and the possible emergence of a secular liberal majority in America. Joining us now is Ira Shapiro, an international trade lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro Rail System. During the Clinton administration, he earned the rank of ambassador, serving as the leading U.S. trade negotiator. His new book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira Shapiro.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And Harry Reid, who is a former boxer, came out today and said, it's better to dance than to fight. But he also said that we're not going to be pushed around anymore. So in these mixed signals about wanting to work with the Republican minority at the same time wanting to deal with their usurpation of power versus the filibuster, what did you take out of his speech warning today?
Well, I think a lot of things get said in the exciting day after an election, particularly one of this consequence. I think it's important, Ian, to remember just how remarkable the Senate elections actually were. A short time ago, several months ago, it seemed the Republicans were sure to take over the Senate because the Democrats were defending so many of the seats. 23 out of 33 were in Democratic hands. And the Republicans looked like they could take the majority. It didn't happen. They not only didn't take the majority, but the Democrats actually gained ground. In the 11 races that were the most hotly contested, the Democrats won 9 of them. They won all over the country. And John Cornyn, who's the senator from Texas, who headed the Republican Senate campaign committee, said, basically, we need to think about this because all wings of our party lost. So Harry Reid is looking at a remarkable result with a strong and strengthened Senate majority. But that doesn't necessarily tell you where things are going to go from here.
Well, I suppose, though, conversely, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, he was actually, I don't think he was particularly gracious in his remarks. He was kind of churlish.
Well, I'm struggling to remember the last time Senator McConnell was gracious about anything.
Okay. Well, I mean, point taken.
The fact is that one important takeaway from this election, and I'm a Democrat, so I'm partisan, but I'm also something of a political historian about the Senate. One important takeaway from this election is I think the country voted against the Republican strategy of obstruction in the Senate. The Republicans used the Senate to obstruct President Obama's legislation and President Obama's nominations. The country has said no to that kind of obstruction. McConnell was the epitome of the obstruction. And so I think that he and the Republicans are going to be under a great deal of pressure to be more cooperative. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to should agree or will agree with President Obama on everything. But I think they're going to have a hard time with the type of going back to the same kind of obstruction that got them this defeat.
So we could talk about, and I want to talk about, the enormous backlog of judicial nominees that have been held up. President Obama is way behind his predecessors, Clinton and Carter, in terms of the judiciary that he's managed to get appointed. And that is why the U.S. judiciary, including the Supreme Court, has moved so far to the right over the decades. And there's obviously a lot of redress is necessary there. But just to back to Harry Reid, what he's saying is that the first thing is the most important thing, to do away with the motion to proceed. Just do away with it. I favor the filibuster. There's a reason for the filibuster. I understand it. It's to protect the rights of the minority. So what's he saying there?
Well, what he's saying is that I think that historically the filibuster protects the rights of the minority party. But it was used in cases that were relatively rare, major cases, major issues. At one time, fewer than 10% of legislative bills were filibustered. Now the filibuster is routine. And we saw hundreds of filibusters, and he's expressing frustration about that, and it's understandable. What he's saying is, the first thing is, there should only be, if there's going to be a filibuster, you shouldn't be able to filibuster the motion to actually take up the legislation. At the present time, you can filibuster the motion to take up the legislation. Then you get 60 votes, you overcome that. Then there's another filibuster on the legislation. So he's saying there shouldn't be two shots at any one bill.
What about putting some skin in the game, going back to the classic movie, Mr. Smith Comes to Washington, where you actually have to stand up and hold up the business to really make your point?
I would favor putting some skin back in the game. I think that Senator Reid was obviously very concerned about the calendar and tying up the Senate, but I think the failure to call the Republicans on the filibusters allowed them to simply filibuster just by indicating they were going to. I think I would have called them to the floor and made them filibuster and held them accountable for what they were doing.
So, again, I'm speaking with Ira Shapiro, who spent 12 years in the United States Senators Council to the Majority Leader and other senior positions where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro Rail System. His latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. So, I guess the real issue here is whether the Senate can change the rules by the majority, which they have. They've increased their majority, or whether they have to have the supermajority to change the rules. And, of course, that makes it impossible, doesn't it? So what's likely to happen here with these pronouncements of Harry Reid's?
Well, this is a debate that we have periodically of whether to resort to what's been called the nuclear option, whereby the Senate moves to change rules by a majority vote as opposed to actually two-thirds that you need to change the rules routinely. There's a high price to be paid for going to the nuclear option. And I think that traditionally what happens in these situations when you actually do get rules changes, it's when you work something out that appeals to more than the majority of the senators. I think that this is actually a moment when many of the senators, Democratic and Republican, share the public's anger and frustration about what the Senate has become. I believe that you actually could accomplish some of these rules changes by enlisting essentially all the Democrats and a considerable, almost all the Democrats and a considerable number of the Republicans. But that remains to be proven. If you try to change the rules by simply a majority, I think it will backfire.
So what's the president going to do and Harry Reid going to do to get the judiciary in more balanced? You know, the courts are dominated by conservative, pro-corporatist judges who the Republicans have put in. And there was a very good judge out here in California that they tried to get through, and he had absolutely perfect qualifications. But the Republicans, because they were mad at this guy for testifying against Sam Alito, and apparently Alito was also mad at him, they just filibustered him out of vengeance.
I'm a strong supporter of President Obama, but I don't think that we, in the first term, that the president pushed hard enough on the judicial nominations. President Bush and some of his Republican predecessors gave a very high priority to judicial nominations. And I think that President Obama, who's a constitutional lawyer and knows the importance of these issues, needs to do the same thing. I think he needs to make public the opposition that he's getting, and I think he needs to hold the Republicans' feet to the fire. If they want to vote down a nomination, that's one thing, but they shouldn't be allowed to kill it by just leaving it in committee. Now, the truth is, their obstruction of his executive branch nominations has actually been even worse than their judicial nominations. But in both cases, the president should be able to get his appointments voted on up or down within a reasonable period of time.
Why doesn't the president put a marker down now that he's won this substantial re-election and basically say, you know, this is leftover business from the last term. You guys have been screwing with me from day one. We're not going to even do any business until we get clear up this backlog. What about that as a tactic?
Well, I think the president and the people around him are undoubtedly sorting through what their priorities are going to be in the lame duck session and in the upcoming session. I believe that he's likely to be very strong on judicial nominations. But I think at the moment, the first thing he's thinking about is an issue you're going to discuss with one of the other people you interview, namely the fiscal cliff and how to avoid it.
Well, indeed, that's what we're going to be doing next. But I still wonder, though, whether, you know, when you get a re-election, I remember George W. Bush said he had a mandate and he wanted to do everything, and he put all his eggs in one basket with privatizing Social Security and went nowhere.
Got nothing, right.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm just afraid that somehow the president's going to go on to a whole new agenda and not take care of what should have been taken care of in the last 4 years, which is his own appointments and the judicial nominees that, you know, have been languishing.
Well, this is a moment, for me, this is a moment of real optimism because of the outcome of the election and the presidential election and the Senate elections. I think that the president is going to have a number of important priorities, and I expect that getting his judicial nominations acted on will be one of them.
So what's your overall sense then of what's going to happen in the Senate? Do you think McConnell's days are numbered? I mean, Cornyn is much more reasonable. I don't know how much the Republicans recognize that they're drubbing. They're not a party that believes in facts and reality so much anymore. But they've got to be still some pragmatists and realists left in the Republican Party, surely.
Well, I think you put it well, Ian. And I think that while they have shown certain reluctance to deal with facts and science, they know something about political victory and political defeat. I think they'll absorb the lesson of this defeat, and I think it will have some effect on their going forward. From my standpoint, as somebody who really believes the Senate needs to be restored, if not what I would call the next great Senate, at least a respectable Senate. I think we could do a lot better with new leaders on both sides. McConnell is a particular problem because he has raised obstruction to an art form. But I think another pair of leaders could make the Senate work quite a bit better.
And I guess the same applies in the House. People are wondering whether Nancy Pelosi could possibly be reelected after two defeats. So that's something also
to
look at.
I'm not as close
sure.
to the House and haven't been studying it. I gather, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker and now the House Democratic leader, she's regarded as considering her options. Right. There's a great deal of loyalty to her among the House Democrats, and there's certainly a great deal of loyalty to Harry Reid among the Senate Democrats.
I think
the most important thing is making these institutions work and
sure.
producing for the American people.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ira Shapiro. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. Take care.
Again, I've been speaking with Ira Shapiro, an international trade lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro Rail System. During the Clinton administration, he earned the rank of ambassador, serving as leading U.S. trade negotiator. And his new book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the House elections and this coming showdown over the so-called fiscal cliff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in the Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
It's good to be here again.
And it looks as though the Democrats are less useless and that the crazy Republicans, Michelle Bachmann survived, and we're not sure about Alan West down in Florida, but certainly on the Senate side, the religious crazies got knocked out, Murdoch and Aiken. So what's your assessment of the Republicans going crazy, the Democrats becoming useless, and we'll talk about the middle class being shafted later?
Well, Romney was probably one of the more plausible candidates that the GOP could nominate, given their field of hopefuls. And the fact that a challenger could not win with a 7.9% national unemployment rate, and of course, unofficially, much higher of people who've given up looking for work or are working part-time and want to work full-time, that would be a kind of thing that would saddle any incumbent with a very uphill climb. But the fact that the Republicans could not win in that environment means the Republican message is just not selling. Now, many Republicans, I think, based on what I've seen, will try to rationalize their defeat. Well, Romney wasn't a real conservative. We didn't communicate our vision properly. We were swimming against rigged polling, the bias of the lamestream media. Hurricane Sandy stalled our momentum, and so on and so forth, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Nevertheless,
their message did not sell. And I think the Democrats did an excellent job of a ground game. Now, in my home state of Ohio, there are 88 counties. And as I recall, I may not have the numbers totally right, but it's within that order of magnitude that the Romney campaign had about 31 field offices in the state. Obama had something like over 130. So he was just blanketing the state of Ohio with a very ferociously targeted ground game. And on the surface, it looks like the super PACs and the fake 501c4 charitable organizations did not swing the election to the GOP, even though the spending by these vehicles was very heavily weighted towards the Republicans. I would be cautious on that because it's only been 2 years since Citizens United, and they're first now just getting on their feet. And in the future, political managers are going to learn how to micro-target campaigns and demographic groups with much greater precision and effort. Karl Rove looked like a buffoon last night, but don't assume there won't be a learning curve.
So, Mike Lofgren, obviously the Democrats decided to put all of their financial efforts into the Senate and the presidency. They probably, I think, figured they didn't have a chance of turning the House back into Democratic control. And conversely, Karl Rove and others and the super PACs and the billionaires poured a lot of money into the Congress, I guess as a firewall against Obama, and they retained control. And an example of the money disparity, Michelle Bachmann, who barely eked out a victory, she outspent her Democratic opponent 12-1. So that seems to be the calculation, right?
Oh, absolutely. It did prevent worse losses. Now, the Democrats actually did well relative to some of the presidential year elections in Congress. The big wave elections tend to be the midterm elections. Now, in Clinton's reelection in 96 and Bush's in 2004, their party in the House only picked up a couple of seats. So I think the 6 or 8 seats or whatever they're projecting now was a fairly creditable performance given how they tended to be outspent. You mentioned Michelle Bachmann's campaign. Now, Freedom Works and the various Tea Party super PACs massively funded Joe Walsh's campaign in Illinois, but he lost. And Alan West is being kind of a sore loser, but last I heard, he was down by 2,500 votes with 100% of the vote in. So I think if it were 250 votes, he might have an issue. 2,500 would probably hold.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working as a congressional Republican staffer in the Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the new book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. So John Boehner has already come forth with the ritual conciliation speech. However, if you listen carefully to what he said, he talks about working together on budget cuts and revenues, but he pretty clearly he wants to retain tax cuts for the rich, and presumably that's a part of why the oligarchs in this country funded them. You know, he danced around it, talked about how we can't possibly have tax increases on the job creators in small business, which nobody, by the way, is talking about doing. So that's their firewall against tax cuts for the rich. So you got the fiscal cliff coming up, and I think more importantly, in late February, you've got the new debt ceiling looming. So given what happened last time with the debt ceiling and the fact that Grover Norquist has most of the Republican House signed up with a no tax increase pledge, if they can finesse the sequester and the so-called fiscal cliff, which I think is being exaggerated, they're still going to really come to the crunch in late February on the debt ceiling.
That's right. Now, of course, one thing you have to understand is John Boehner, who's kind of a country club Republican of the old school, is walking a fine line because he's going to be the one or one of the Republicans to negotiate the whole fiscal cliff negotiations, and that has to be done before January 1st. Well, the next election for Speaker of the House doesn't come until after that, so it's kind of like a political gun to his head. He can't diss the extreme fiscal conservatives in his faction, and I'm sure Eric Cantor is waiting in the wings to take the job away from him if he were to cut a deal with President Obama on getting out of the fiscal cliff. I think, having heard what he said, it actually sounded a little more conciliatory than what Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, the Republican leader in the Senate, said, which sort of sounded like sour grapes.
Sure, he's basically trying, which seems to be endemic in the Republican Party nowadays, denying data and denying reality, this sort of anti-science bias that they have. He's more or less saying that you can only be a move to the right, President Obama, even though this election looks like a kind of win for liberal, secular America.
Yeah, well, he said something to the effect that the president shouldn't think that the American public was rewarding him for his failures and excesses, which on election night sounds kind of churlish.
Sure, but I think the bottom line is he's more or less saying, you know, you can only move to the right and the center, you can't move to the left. And the point is that the left is what showed up last night, or yesterday, at least.
Well, or just people who weren't quite ready for people like Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch and some of the other crazies.
Sure.
I mean, there's a lot of people who do not necessarily buy the Democratic or the liberal or the progressive philosophy, who nonetheless, it scares the daylights out of them that there's a party that's anti-science, that is apparently denying the facts of human reproductive biology.
So back to the House then, Mike Lofgren. What's your sense, though, of how much they can finesse? None of them want the sequester. They don't want the cuts on the Pentagon budget. And, of course, you know, concurrently, the same percentage is going to be taken out of all of the other government departments. So it's a very blunt instrument, the sequester. But it may, in many ways, be the only way to get the defense budget cut, which, of course, is ludicrously high.
Well, yeah, it would need to be reduced in any case, in my opinion, having looked at it professionally for a couple of decades in my job in the House and Senate. However, I think the fact that they're so protective of defense does give Obama a lever for negotiating a deal on other matters as well, whether it's cuts in domestic spending, tax increases, and so forth. And for that matter, I've always thought that the fiscal cliff is not Armageddon. It could have, the spending cuts could have some short-term effects. Mainly they'd be in the Washington area because so much of that spending occurs here. The tax increases wouldn't hit immediately, and it would bring back the tax rates that were in the 1990s. Under Clinton, and to be honest, a Republican Congress, we had pretty decent growth rates then, and the tax rates then didn't seem to impede the economy. There's no reason to think that a 4-point increase in the top marginal rate is going to cause this country to sink to the level of poverty of Somalia.
Well,
that matter, the Department of Defense would be cut back to the level of 2006 or 2007. That's not a horrible cut.
Well, of course, I think Boehner made it pretty clear. He put down a marker that no tax cuts no ending tax cuts for the rich or the top percent. He tried to suggest it's all about not punishing small business when it's protecting the privileges of billionaires. And he also said that he can make up revenues through closing tax loopholes. Also, that's what Romney said. I mean, that's a bit of a chimera, isn't it?
Well, that's totally a non-starter, because when you say that you can make up for billions in tax cuts for the rich, as Romney did, by closing tax loopholes, there aren't enough tax loopholes of this sort of corporate jets variety to even remotely approach that. What that means is you have to take away the tax deductions of middle-class people on their home mortgage deduction, on the health care exclusion, and things like that, child tax credit. And politically, let's be realistic, that is impossible.
So, Mike Lufkin, what about then if they can somehow paper this over or kick the can down the road? In late February, you have the increase in the debt ceiling, and your book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. You had a ringside seat at these amazing antics of these various deficit reduction commissions. But the long and the short of it is you have the Tea Party. I was watching their spokesperson today on television again, refusing to talk about revenues, refusing to talk about taxing the rich, even though they're supposed to be a grassroots movement, and all about deficit reduction. So you can see the kind of lines being drawn here, and you've got Grover Norquist having intimidate them all into signing this pledge. Won't it be a repeat of what happened last time?
I don't, I could be wrong, but I don't think so. They didn't come out of that looking very good. They did not come out of the whole fiasco where Standard & Poor's downgraded the debt looking like a governing party or a potential governing party. They looked like fools. They looked intransigent. They looked, some of them, like Joe Walsh, fanatical. And I think, for instance, on the extension last Christmas of the payroll tax cut, which Obama wanted because its payroll tax is very regressive, it stops at $110,000, so it's going to hit mainly working people. A lot of Republicans didn't want to continue it because it didn't have anything to do with the Koch brothers' fortunes. But they understood at the end of the day that they were just going to get clobbered with this. And I think the public is a little more educated about what the debt ceiling is and the consequences of children playing with matches, which is what the House Republicans were doing in 2011.
So, Mike Lufkin, and just in the last minute or so then, are you saying that these people who have exhibited less than rational behavior and are denying reality, science, and facts have had a cold shower, that they are rational enough to notice that the American people, by and large, repudiated their positions, and whether they are religious fanatics or Tea Party anti-tax zealots? The long and the short of it is, the reality seems to be intruding, but I'm not sure that a lot of them are immune to that, aren't they?
Well, a lot of them are, but there is, I presume, a group of them that have learned that you can't just keep bashing your head against a brick wall and expect the brick wall to fall down. And the repudiation they got at the polls, when they all expected in their kind of reality-challenged bubble for Romney to win, has to have something of a sobering-up effect. I mean, I'm not saying that they're all going to, come to their senses, but the cold fear of being held in contempt by the public, if they perpetrate another fiasco, may make them do the right thing, whether they want to or not.
Well, just in closing then, Mike Lofgren, you mentioned Bain is looking over his shoulder because Eric Cantor is clearly undermining him at every moment and is a very, very ambitious and I would assume somewhat ruthless operator there. And he's got the Tea Party caucus in his pocket. So do you think there's going to be a showdown between those two and that the more reasonable guy is going to win?
That's to be determined. I think I've laid out the scenario of the negotiations over resolving the fiscal cliff and when the speaker's election is. So stay tuned. Put the popcorn in the microwave.
So you don't think then that the fact that these are the very thing that we're talking about, that these elections, as they say, have consequences, that this puts some gives Boehner, who's not a fanatic from what I understand, a little more strength and ammunition and comfort, if you will, that he doesn't have to keep compromising because he's afraid of the people looking over his shoulder.
Well, it may strengthen his ability to do a deal, but of course the future is not predetermined, and there's a lot of tugging and toing and froing in the Republican conference. So, again, I just say stay tuned.
Right. Well, I guess there aren't too many moderates left in there, so your point's well taken. I thank you for joining us, Mike Lofgren.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed being here.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress as a Republican staffer, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on top Hurricane Katrina disaster relief debates on the Pentagon budget and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We're going to take a brief station break and be back discussing whether or not the religious right is on the wane and secular liberal America is on the rise.
So there's a band in that track, and the father's fighting in a sack. Because we're way too wise, as for that. You might find some fools at your doorstep, hustling the latest changes to the book of the stage in an attempt to multiply.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tanya Lerman, who's a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tanya Lerman.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And with the election of a lesbian to the United States Senate, gay marriage passing in Maine and Maryland, and marijuana legalized in Colorado and Washington State, the country apparently did not heed Paul Ryan's warning that Obama was putting America on a dangerous path that compromises Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. What mm-hmm. happened?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that it doesn't mean that the country is any less evangelical. In fact, more evangelicals voted for or a higher percentage of white evangelicals voted for the Republican candidate this time than they did in 2008. So they're still quite active. The shift is, as some of the commentators suggested last night, is a demographic shift. So there are there's a kind of a wider variety of views out there. And particularly younger people seem to be more liberal on social values than they have been in previous decades.
So how much of yesterday's election a watershed with the apparent waning of the religious right and the possible emergence of a secular liberal majority in America?
Well, I don't think it is a waning of the religious right. Again, I mean, about the same percentage voted for the Republican candidate and about the same numbers voted as had in previous elections. I think there is there's a demographic shift, and it may be that that shift will mean that the religious right will be less powerful. I actually think that the difference will arise from, in part, the shift among the younger evangelical voters. So what we know about that world is that 30% of them are significantly more liberal on social issues than their parents. And I think that is true for young people across the country.
So with 60% of Protestants voting for Romney, 40% for Obama, 70% of Jewish Americans voted for Obama, 30% voted for Romney, in spite of some fairly vigorous appeals and a lot of money from the pro-Israel lobby. So there is, I can see that in terms of this idea, I mean, the Paul Ryan's notion of a Judeo-Christian Western civilization values being compromised, that was pretty hard to swallow in the first place, but there's certainly no evidence that there's such a thing, right?
Oh, which thing?
There's no evidence that that Obama is taking the country on, or at least if there's any evidence that Obama is taking the country on the path towards compromising Judeo-Christian Western civilization values, the American people certainly did not heed Paul Ryan's warning.
Yes, I think they certainly imagine those values differently than he does. Again, I don't think that this is a there's any big shift in either the religiosity of the country or the eagerness with which right-wing evangelical voters are voting. I just think that the demographics are different, and that's what's leading to the differences in the appearance at the polls.
So you think we're making too much of the defeat of Todd Akin in Missouri and Richard Murdoch in Indiana?
They are idiots. And, you know, I mean, and with due respect, I mean, but many, many people, no matter what their religious convictions, can't take seriously the idea that a woman's body shuts down when she's been raped, or the idea that, you know, God intended somebody to become pregnant as a result of a rape. It's, I mean, that's a vision of God that is very odd for many people, no matter where they stand on the spectrum.
Well, but so, he got literally within half of the votes in Indiana. So it's not as if he's not being supported in any way. And frankly, even though you're right to say that what he was saying was bizarre, to put it politely, he was speaking honestly. And a lot of politicians don't speak honestly. So to some extent, I give the guy credit for actually saying what he believes, whereas the more pragmatic Republicans who may not share these staunch anti-abortion beliefs nevertheless go along with the dogma.
I wouldn't take a vote for or against the conservative candidate as necessarily a support for or against one of his stupider comments. I certainly think that it may have swayed enough voters to usher their opponents into the House. But I don't think that, you know, they still stand for a certain kind of set of political commitments. I do think that the old evangelical coalition is breaking down. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that in this election, but I do think you see the evidence for that in the future as the younger religious voters grow up. I mean, it's also pretty clear that you saw an age structure in the support for Romney and Obama in which older, you know, the older you were, the more male you were, the more likely you were to support Romney. And the younger you were, you know, and the women are more likely to support Obama. So those are real differences that I think will also transform over time. I do think the Republican Party has a problem on its hands, not so much about religion as about these new voters, particularly Hispanic voters, that are I think, changing the face of the American electorate.
Well, in terms of the young being, and particularly the millennials, being sort of post-racial and post-sexual, they're neither obsessed with people's sexuality nor, and they're by and large colorblind. I suppose to some extent, though, in terms of evangelical dynasties, the younger Franklin Graham, who managed to broker a deal between his father, Billy Graham, and mm-hmm. Mitt Romney, he's actually extremely conservative, more so than his father, and is indulged in birther conspiracies against Obama. Mm-hmm. That was interesting in as much as that when they made that deal, and you know, Billy Graham had sworn he would never endorse a president after Watergate. His friend Nixon got embarrassed him. But nevertheless, they immediately took down from the website the Billy Graham Crusade's objections to Mormonism as a cult.
That was, to me, the most amazing feature of the election, that Romney's Mormonism doesn't seem to have mattered at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems to be the case. But can you make an argument that that is because our press has been useless and the Democrats have been largely feckless? Romney got away with not revealing his taxes, which would set a terrible mm-hmm. precedent. He got away with not revealing his list of money bundlers, which all of his predecessors had done since Watergate. And he
got away with a complex relation with accuracy in many of his debate statements.
That's true, and then he managed to somehow get Mormonism to be off the table. Nobody really mm-hmm. asked him questions about his relationship, and particularly the financial relationship with the church, which Bloomberg were looking into at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I'm not actually that so troubled that the press didn't push him on his religious convictions.
Mm-hmm.
But I am interested in the fact that his stretched accuracy, as it were, was less targeted by the press. And I think one of the challenges that we have in this country is that the press that's read by many of the liberal readers is worried about appearing to be too liberal. They want to woo back conservative readers. And so in many ways, they are hesitant to appear to be too liberal.
Well, it seems that the so-called, I mean, wouldn't you agree, though, that the notion of a liberal press is largely a manufactured canard? And if they're retreating back that way, they're retreating back from a illusion that the right has crafted.
You know, you can make that argument, but I also do think that the presses like the New York Times tend to have more liberal commentators, although they certainly have some more conservative ones. And it's certainly true that many, on average, more people in the university tend to vote the Democratic ticket. And, you know, I think that large part is because the claims in the Democratic ticket are claims made by more liberal politicians make more sense to those people.
Well, you have to at least credit the New York Times with having the only accurate pollster in Nate Silver.
Oh, my goodness. There was a great sign that was going around Facebook yesterday that said something like, "Be calm, have faith in Nate Silver." And it was quite striking that there was this kind of drumbeat of the razor-thin margin, the neck-and-neck competition, whereas he had been predicting for quite a while that it was very likely that Obama would win.
So that may be an explanation, though, that the press is not so much liberal or conservative, but they're simply interested in a competition
story
and keeping people's attention. So they're not about to admit that it's going to be a walkover, and they want to engage people in a cliffhanger that they're largely ginning up.
That's right. And despite the fact that the election was in effect predicted by Nate Silver as being highly probable to tip towards Obama, it's still true that we have a very polarized, divided country. Religion does play an important role, or at least exemplify some of those divisions. And that's not going to go away in the immediate future.
Well, it here in California, the one proposition that failed, of course, was Prop 34. I interviewed he was a young man at the age of 17. He was arrested and convicted of murdering his mother, which he did not do. His father was an attorney, and a conservative attorney at that. And this kid got railroaded and spent 26 years in a California prison and only avoided the death penalty because he was 3 months under the age of 18, and otherwise he would have been eligible. And he was, you know, stumping on behalf of Prop 34. And it was a very, very powerful and shattering story that he told. And, you know, he's a white kid from the privileged background in the San Fernando Valley that got railroaded and almost was executed. So it was a very passionate and powerful advocacy, but nevertheless, people didn't, buy it. And I think that's a part of, isn't that a part of the lexicon of the religious right? They're in favor of capital punishment, even though for example, the Catholic Church has a much more consistent theology in terms of being pro-life, both in terms of abortion and being opposed to capital punishment.
You know, I don't know if there's a consistent position for the death penalty within the evangelical church. It's not. I am pretty sure that the churches where I spend time would not take that position. Do we know what? I'm not sure we know the composition of the vote against the against the abolition of the death penalty yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it's just, I just have this prejudice, perhaps, that most of what I see in terms of evangelical television, et cetera, seems to be a front for right-wing politics. And that's the inconsistency that I've always felt, that, you know, the prophet Jesus, who is that we are supposed to be following, you know, he didn't advocate capital punishment. He didn't advocate assault weapons. He didn't hate homosexuals, et cetera, and didn't ask for money from poor people. In fact, he did the reverse. He, you know, commanded us to help the poor.
So the piece of this I understand best is the attitude towards what you might call entitlements or handouts or government help. I think that when many people in theologically conservative churches and evangelical churches, when they understand themselves, they see themselves in relationship to Jesus. They see themselves as changing in relationship to Jesus and developing over time, becoming a better person through that relationship. And, you know, they don't quite, there's a sense that you're discovering who you are in that relationship and you're changing over time. Their model of sin is addiction. And addiction is the shadow that falls between you and God. In that way of thinking, government support sounds like addiction, and it sounds like an entitlement. It doesn't sound like something that's a help. It doesn't sound like social justice. It sounds like something that keeps you down and prevents you from being the better non-addicted person that you can be. So, I mean, I know that sounds a little odd to somebody who thinks about social welfare as a kind of social justice, but it is. But I've come to understand that this is part of the way that evangelicals can come to understand something like healthcare, something like welfare, something like Social Security, that is a long-term aid from the government that looks more like the dependency to them, an addiction to them, than benevolence and toleration.
Well, does that explain then that to some extent, it's hard for me to understand where the theology ends and where the politics begin, though, in that regard, because so much of the evangelical church nowadays preaches the gospel of prosperity. Osteen, who's, I think, one of the leading lights down there, you know, says his mantra is, you know, God doesn't want you to be a whiner. God wants you to be a winner. And I'm just wondering, I mean, that seems to me not much different from sort of motivational speakers, let alone the kind of Elmer Gantry kind of hue that one approaches most televangelists with, that sort of skepticism.
But from that perspective, Democrats look like whiners. They look weak. They look lazy. They look like they're not trying. And, you know, whatever you think about Joel Osteen's perspective, he captures a way of thinking about the world that helps to invite you into a more right-wing perspective. It's a way of thinking, and if you think about it, not focusing on the prosperity gospel, but thinking about it as an invitation into being a certain kind of person, a better person. You know, a better person is not going to need a government handout. A government handout will keep you down and is a sign that you have not yet become the person you could be. And when you start understanding that perspective, you can begin to understand why that, you know, hesitation seems so compelling to people. I mean, the big story of why the evangelical church became right-wing probably has something to do with the kinds of pastors that rose to prominence as the hippie Christians began to build a new kind of Christianity in the late 60s. But the language that makes sense to people within those churches, which helps them to remain Republican and see the Republican perspective as the right one to hold, has... I don't think that people are just accepting a politics from the pulpit. They are also thinking about what it means to be in relationship with Jesus. And it's certainly plausible from that perspective that Jesus would not want you to be dependent. It's a very powerful emotional sensibility, I think, within many of these churches. There's a powerful invitation to be the person that God wants you to be and not to depend on, not to rely on. I mean, this thing about addiction is really very real within these churches. And the idea that somebody should ask for help from the government, that's why it can come to seem weak. If you were a strong person, you would just be able to be the person who wouldn't need that dependent help.
Well, Tanya Lemon, I thank you so much for joining us. You really have helped, I think, me and others understand what is motivating so many people who often are the subject of derision, even though they are a huge chunk of our population here.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tanya Lemon, who's a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at Facebook/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.